Committee on Commerce to order at this time. We have a couple of housekeeping rules we need to go over first. First, I want to let you know if you're standing up, if the state police ask you to move to another location, I'm not sure what room they're using, but we do have an overflow room. And so for exit safety matters, we may actually have to ask you to move to another room. For those that are here in this room, we're asking that if you have any type of a cell phone or electronic device, that you turn it off now. That means beyond silent or vibrate. The reason for that is because our PA system is affected by the transmission of some of the equipment that's used by individuals, and it will actually distort the tapes that are being done for the internet as well as for the archives. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee bills. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In front of the committee are Legislative Council Concepts 2007, 2143, and 1941. I could go into detail on these bills. These are just asked to introduce them as committee bills.
All right, if no one wants greater discussion on the introduction at this time, the chair would take a motion for the three bills.
Mr. Chair, I would move LC 1941, LC 2007, and LC 2143 be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 1941, 2007, and 2143 as to be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Not hearing any. Is there any objection? Not hearing any. So ordered. And this time I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 400. And the way we're going to go with this, first of all, we have three bills that we have scheduled today. As you can imagine, we may not be able to get to all the testimony. So we're going to divide these out and have the testimony on Senate Bill 400 as first. If we're able to get through 400, then we'll move into 401. At this point, the chair is not planning on moving any of the bills, and they're only scheduled, they are scheduled for a possible work session, but I assure you no bill is moving out of this committee today. With that said, what we're going to do is we have a group of individuals that will first set up the framework for Senate Bill 400, and that is going to be Bob Livingston, Duke Shepard, I believe, and I'm not sure if Ken Adams is on that one. Okay, just Livingston and Shepard will give us that overview. We also have a rule here that if you traveled over 100 miles, that we get your testimony first, so we make certain we get it captured, and we'll call on those people next, individuals, I should say, and then we'll start in with the list, and we'll do our best to get everyone through. And we only have one. Is this the only list we have right now, Anna?
This is the second part.
Okay, it looks like there's not as many people signed up as in the room to give testimony on 400.
There are another.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and start letting people give their testimony. If it seems like we're running short on time, I may ask you to shorten your time. I will ask each and every one, when you hear testimony that's been given prior to your own testimony that is the same, if you could just truncate that part of your testimony, you can say we are in agreement with what other people have said and whatever that summary is, and move into other areas that are not covered. It would serve the purpose of allowing more people to testify. With that said, Mr. Livingston, Mr. Shepard, if you go ahead and identify yourselves and move forward. But first, I want to have counsel just give us the preview of what Senate Bill 400 is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 400 changes the definition of employment relations in the Public Employment Collective Bargaining Act for those public employees who are prohibited from striking to include staffing levels and safety issues that have a potential impact on the job safety and the workload of the employees.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I'm a firefighter here in Salem, but I'm also the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And today my testimony and opinions will be that representing those of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Senate Bill 400 is a common-sense, straightforward bill that simply allows your firefighters, police, correction officers, and other non-strikeable groups to discuss safety and staffing levels that have a potential impact on job safety, a right currently afforded to many other hardworking Oregonians, such as nurses, electricians, and iron workers, just to name a few. Unfortunately, many people and groups either do not understand public employee collective bargaining laws or simply do not want employees to discuss these during bargaining. I'd like to think that I could end my testimony with that, but certainly by the attendance in the room, I think I would need to bring you up to speed on a few more issues. The current problem that we currently have is under the current law, in order to discuss safety issues, employees must be able to show that the safety issue has a direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees. The reason that we're having a problem with this particular language is that the Employment Relations Board has made it clear that under the current statutory scheme, when the subject of a proposal concerns safety, staffing, or workload, we are required to determine its effect in order to determine its bargaining status. Determining the effect is like waiting for an officer to get shot. It can only be proven as an afterthought. To date, it is my understanding that since 1995, the Employment Relations Board has never ruled in favor of employees on whether or not safety or certain staffing levels are a mandatory subject of bargaining. Prior to 1995, issues surrounding on-the-job safety required a discussion. Senate Bill 400 corrects this inequity. And of all the people in Oregon, you would think that your public safety officers would have the ability to discuss safety issues. I think later this afternoon you'll hear many arguments about that. I'd like to simply address some of those and give you a little more background on that. Some of the arguments that you will hear from the opponents of this bill is that it's too costly. Another argument that you're going to hear is that it takes away local control from elected officials. A third is you're going to hear arguments that every issue can be regarded as having a potential impact on safety and staffing. And finally, another argument that you may or may not hear is that safety is paramount to every public safety executive in Oregon, and OSHA also enforces safety, therefore this bill is unnecessary. If I could, I'd expend just a little bit of time addressing some of these concerns. With respect to too costly, I think it's important to note that prior to 1995, when these issues were able to be discussed, I don't think you'll find any factual information that showed that because we were able to discuss safety issues that it drove up the cost of collective bargaining. In fact, I don't think there's been any information or facts brought forward in the past three legislative sessions that would show this. In addition, current law provides employers with two significant and extremely effective tools, last final best offer and the ability to pay. Last final best offer simply is a requirement that's in statute that simply requires if a bargaining agreement is not reached at the table, and I think it's important to note that I would say that 90% of all bargaining issues are agreed at the table, roughly 10% end up having to go to arbitration. If you can't reach the agreement, the arbitrator is forced to either choose one package or the other package. So it's an all or nothing. Basically, if I could, it's a high stake poker, winner take all type of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so clearly that we believe because of that, it makes both sides have their arguments be extremely close together. Their offers have to be close together. And we think that is something that clearly, while I think you'll get to hear arguments that people don't like it, the fact of the matter is it has done what it was intended to do, bring offers closer together. The other issue that I think is an important one for you to remember is an ability to pay. One of the criteria that an arbitrator must look at is an ability to pay. And if you were to take the time and go to the Employment Relations Board site and look at all the arbitration awards, I think you would clearly recognize that they give huge deference towards ability to pay. Some will argue that the ability to pay is only with inside the bargaining unit. It's going to have an impact on this part of local government over here. And so what I'd like to do is frame for you exactly how the language is written in the statutes. And I quote, ability to pay. The reasonable financial ability of the unit of government to meet the cost of the proposed contract, giving due consideration and weight to other services provided by and other priorities of the unit of government as determined by the governing body. A reasonable operating reserve against future contingencies, which does not include funds in contemplation of settlement of the labor dispute, shall not be considered as available toward a settlement. And you can find that at ORS 243-746 sub 4B. In addition to that, Mr. Chair, if I may, just randomly, I went through some arbitrations, and I'm not going to read the entire awards, but I just want to point out and emphasize the ability to pay is an effective tool that employers have. And here's just a few of the an excerpt from some of the arbitration awards. Quote, public employers such as the City of Kaiser have many competing needs for every dollar. Any cost differential may raise serious questions. However, in this case, the cost difference between the last best offers of the parties is minimal, and adoption of the association's last best offer will have little economic effect on the public. End quote. In another decision, another arbitrator stated the following. Quote, public employers in general and cities in particular always have many competing priorities for every dollar. The additional cost of the association proposal here is not massive, but neither is it entirely insignificant. Because none of the statutory secondary factors provide substantial support for the adoption of the association's proposal, and because it appears that the city's proposal will continue to keep its overall police compensation comparable and probably will not adversely affect its recruitment and retention experience, I must award the city's proposal in this case, end quote. The reason I want to bring those quotes to your attention is that clearly, you know, some will argue that, well, I don't want an arbitrator making a decision. Some of them come from out of state, and really it's none of their business. I would make the counter-argument that these are very highly trained professionals, and they do listen to the statutory language, and they are required to pay attention to those things. And keep in mind, that's how they make their living. And so they do give huge deference to the ability to pay. Another issue I think you'll hear today from some folks is that this bill would take away local control from elected officials. We don't believe that's the case. If an employer feels that increased staffing in a public safety department or better safety equipment and practices will negatively impact other services that the government seeks to offer, the employer is free to make those arguments at the bargaining table and to make those arguments to an interest arbitrator. Further, and while a bullet fired at a Pendleton police officer or a Portland police officer is not going to discriminate, or a firefighter that is trapped in a burning building without radio communications in Medford or Salem is not going to discriminate, this bill actually does allow for local control to take place in the bargaining unit. And so an alternative to this that we certainly, and I think some senators in the past have argued, we certainly could contemplate national standards out there and put in all of these standards at the state level for both police, fire, and some other public safety. Certainly, police chiefs and fire chiefs have national organizations and have supported national standards. But if we were to do that, certainly you would truly take away local control. But clearly there are standards out there that we all follow and that have been out there in some states' mandate. And so that isn't an alternative to this bill. But we think having flexibility and having that discussion at the local level is more appropriate. But again, I think there's no arguing that national standards have been recognized by many of the chief executives that will be talking to you today. Another issue I think that you may hear is that every issue can be regarded as having a potential impact on safety and staffing. Some points on that I think you need to keep in mind is that this proposal requires only that the employer be open to discuss safety and staffing issues at the bargaining table. It does not impose the union's will. Further, not all staffing related issues need to be discussed. As an example, if a bargaining unit in a fire bargaining unit wanted to argue over we need more fire prevention officers, clearly an employer would not have to discuss that because there would be no nexus between that on the job safety. And so certain things are required by this bill, others aren't. In addition, another safeguard that employers have that's in this current statutory language and that will continue to be in the language is those issues that are de minimis or insubstantial are not considered mandatory subjects of bargaining. What I mean by things that are insubstantial or de minimis is in the past we've heard arguments that, well, if we open this up, firefighters are going to want to talk about, you know, we need to require to have stocking caps, or we've even heard testimony in the past that some police officers are going to want to talk about Trillium night sights. Well, even if that's the case, an arbitrator, if it comes down to a last final best offer, those kind of issues are going to be determined to be de minimis and insubstantial. And further, I don't think there's any bargaining units that would risk a last final best offer over a stocking cap or some issue like Trillium night sights. And not only would this more than likely be considered to be a de minimis subject, even if it wasn't, there is a specific timetable for negotiations that also requires there's a time frame for when there's not an agreement, and so it's not going to delay anything. There's still requirements, set timetables for when you have to have your bargaining contract done. Finally, like their private sector colleagues, public managers can simply say no. Collective bargaining does not require concessions on any particular item. And I think that's an important point to emphasize. Employers can always say no in bargaining. The same example can be for safety as it is on, you know, a wage increase. They still have the ability. We just want the ability to have the discussion. Finally, excuse me, Mr. Chair. The last point that I'd like to point out is I think you'll hear points from the opponents of this bill is that safety is paramount to every public safety executive, and that OSHA already requires standards to be in place. And while I don't disagree with that, I think you will also find that almost every mission statement or every public safety executive will argue that safety of employees is top priority and that OSHA is also there to enforce safety rules. If this is truly the case, and if employers and executives agree with this philosophy, what is the harm in allowing for an open and free discussion regarding safety and staffing levels that have an impact on the job safety? Employers who are truly operating in this fashion should not be fearful of this modest readjustment in our current bargaining law, but rather embrace the concept. To simply hide under the guise of this philosophy or OSHA is not only insulting to the men and women who risk their lives every day to protect others, it simply does not serve the public's interest. Finally, in my closing remarks, Mr. Chair, I think it is worthy of noting that on January 31st, 1973, in the House Labor Committee, a task force formed by Governor Tom McCall introduced a draft bill that, with the help from then-counsel to the committee, Ted Kulongoski, would become the framework for what is now known as Oregon's Public Collective Bargaining Act, PECBA. As part of this landmark legislation, the legislative body declared in part that, and I quote, experience in private and public employment has also proved that protection by law of the right of employees to organize and negotiate collectively safeguards employees and the public from injury, impairment, interruptions of necessary services, and removes certain recognized sources of strife and unrest. By encouraging practices fundamental to the peaceful adjustment of disputes arising out of differences as to wages, hours, terms, and other working conditions, and by establishing greater equality of bargaining power between public employers and public employees, end quote. Since that time, we have seen many challenges and changes in our communities and country. Unfortunately, not all of them pleasant, and many of them indelible. For many in this room, not a day goes by without remembering the day America changed forever, where 343 firefighters gave the supreme sacrifice on 9/11 as the World Trade Center towers came crashing down. Whether it is another terrorist attack, a natural disaster such as Hurricane Katrina, or the day-to-day emergency service call your firefighters, police officers, and others respond to, one thing is for certain. The job of your public safety officers will continue to be challenging and dangerous. This bill cannot solve or prevent all of the challenges faced by today's firefighters and other public safety officers. But it can restore a right that this institution once recognized, the right of employees to discuss safety and staffing levels that have an impact on the job safety. Everyday firefighters, police officers, and others risk their lives to save others. We would certainly ask for your support of Senate Bill 400. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions, or would you rather?
Let Mr. Shepard speak, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, members of the committee, my name is Duke Shepard. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and thank you for the opportunity. Safety is a key component of working conditions in any work environment, and it's a reasonable expectation in any workplace, particularly a high-risk workplace, that safety and staffing would be among the matters eligible for negotiation in a collective bargaining environment. This is true for a myriad of other professions, from ironworkers to electricians. It's notable that this body in prior sessions has taken steps to allow registered nurses to have direct and substantial ability to raise issues of safety and staffing in their work environment. Arguments against this bill that are based on a claim that an arbitrator will be likely to unilaterally redirect large amounts from local government budgets are at best speculative and certainly contrary to existing evidence and experience. The current standard for binding arbitration is last, best, final offer, not first, largest offer. If the arguments against this bill are based on the potential behavior of an arbitrator, despite all of the experience since 1995, we would suggest that those are ultimately arguments against last, best, final offer binding arbitration rather than against this bill. Overall, last, best, final offer binding arbitration appears to have worked as intended. However, if this bill is demonstrating that others have a desire to revisit last, best, final offer binding arbitration and return to pre-1995 arbitration methods, we would be open to that discussion. People whose work involves being surrounded by flames, criminals, or convicts should be able to discuss the safety and staffing issues at the table. Raising these issues at the table will have consequences within the bargaining environment and inherently involve direct trade-offs. Those who bring the issues to the table within the context of their proposals will have to be prepared to make trade-offs among their own priorities. Addressing staffing and safety issues, whether or not there is a direct or indirect cost, will impact the amount available for wages and benefits, as well as any non-monetary issues that can be addressed in bargaining. Last, best, final offer binding arbitration assures this. Please support Senate Bill 400. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either member or either of the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, just briefly, I know the way it used to be, but picking an arbitrator, if you reach an impasse, you have to pick an arbitrator. You still go to a panel of arbitrators or several and have a bumping thing that happens until you're left with just one. Is that still the way it works?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, that's correct. I believe it's either five or seven, and each side starts striking, and then there's one left, and that arbitrator is the one that then decides the case. And so each side kind of weighs in, similar to, I guess, two attorneys that are try to select a jury, get certain picks that you get to throw out, and then you end up with one left over.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that's still the way it worked. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, if
yes,
I may.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Livingston, you represent Portland also, firefighters?
That's correct, under the State umbrella. Firefighters Council.
If you could just pass on this thought, please, that thanks for their successful efforts to control what was a terrible and devastating fire resulting in destruction, the loss of the historic church in North Portland. That loss is being deeply felt, widely felt by a whole Portland community, and we appreciate their efforts and the courage that it takes to go in and do what they do in a situation like that. But they also protected and prevented a lot of other loss, not just to property but to life, and we're very appreciative.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we appreciate that, and we too feel the loss. We too live in these communities, and it's unfortunate, and we appreciate the kind words.
All right, with that, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. We have a panel here from Pendleton, and I'm going to ask those gentlemen to please step forward. I believe it's no, that's not them.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that'll be next.
Okay.
And whoever wants to start off first, just
I'll
give
start, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Allen. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent some 2,600 public safety workers around the state, both in state and local government units, corrections officers, police officers, 911 operators, parole officers, detention facility workers. I don't want to repeat what's been said earlier, but we think it's of extreme importance that we be allowed to bargain over safety issues, those ought to be mandatory topics. The most productive work that can happen around safety issues can happen at the bargaining table through good, thorough discussions over those issues with the parties facing each other eyeball to eyeball. Significant improvements can be made there. We are now faced with employers that refuse to discuss safety issues because they call them permissive topics. They won't engage in those discussions whatsoever. And we're forced to do such things as, in previous sessions, we brought a bill to this body to ban free weights from our corrections facilities after one of our members was almost killed by an inmate swinging a weight bar. The employer was not going to remove those free weights from the institutions, and we had to bring a bill here. Frankly, that's silly. We should be able to bargain those issues. I want to turn it over to two of our corrections officers that work in facilities where there's been serious assaults in the last 6 months. Robert Kennedy is from Two Rivers Corrections Institute, and Dennis Caswell from Eastern Oregon's Corrections.
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Kennedy, and I'm a correctional officer for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am also president of Local 974 out of TRCI in Umatilla, Oregon. And I stand in support of Senate Bill 400. This bill would give us the ability to sit down with our managers and discuss necessary safety and staffing issues that are directly affecting our prison facilities today. I can only tell you of individual occurrences that have occurred at our facility very, very recently. Approximately a month ago, we have a female correctional officer named Alicia Alford. While working inside one of the housing units, she was assaulted by a very violent inmate who decided to take his bodily fluid and thrust it forward and landed on front of her face. This inmate has absolutely no opportunity for parole. He was also very well aware that he was hepatitis positive for many, many years, and it was his intent in order to assault her in this manner. I would have loved to have the ability to speak to our managers about this safety issue. We now have a correctional officer who is taking anti-medication that they give them inside of the emergency room that makes her very ill. Her entire life has been turned around. She does not know whether or not she is going to contract this hepatitis from this inmate. But I do not have that ability because they consider this issue a permissive subject of bargaining. For years, I have personally tried to work on barrier protection through our managers in order to ensure that these items don't occur. But this, again, is still considered a permissive subject of bargaining, and they will not discuss the issue with us. Approximately 6 months ago, I was assaulted by an inmate, Bergstedt, while working in a disciplinary I was working on Housing Unit 4 at the time. After this inmate assaulted me, the district attorney's office in Umatilla County has now preferred charges for assault in the first degree, a felony against this inmate. He was expected to get out very soon. However, with the Department of Corrections and their disciplinary process, they decided only to provide him 7 days of disciplinary segregation for his assault upon me. I would have loved to have the ability to sit down with my managers and discuss the amount of discipline that this inmate received for assaulting me, but I do not have that ability because it is a permissive subject of bargaining. And I'd also like to touch on another subject that deals with staffing. Within the past 12 months at TRCI, we have had two of our correctional staff members, after working forced overtime for 16 hours, get inside of their vehicles and while driving home, falling asleep at the wheel, totaling their vehicles and causing injury. I would like to have the ability to sit down with the managers and maybe try to come up with some other plan to ensure that that doesn't happen to our staff members that are forced into overtime situations. But unfortunately, I don't have that ability. This would give us the opportunity to sit down with the managers and work through these very, very important safety issues that are important to everybody that works for not only my members, but throughout the department. And I'd appreciate your support on this. Thank you. I'd like to turn this over also to Dennis Caswell.
I'm Dennis Caswell, Sergeant, Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. I've been employed by the department for 15 years. I'm here to talk to you about everyday people like you and I that happen to work inside a correctional facility. We understand that there's an inherent risk going inside that facility every day. We understand that, but we would like to have some say as to the safety mechanisms that we have in place and that we don't have in place. In 1991 at EOCI, we have two rec yards at EOCI, large yards, large enough for inmates to play football, baseball, soccer, and a weight pile on those yards. Above the yards is a tower where staff members should be with weapons overlooking the yard for the staff's protection and the other inmates' protection. 1991, we didn't have anybody in those towers. Officer Michaels was walking the weight pile where inmates work out. He told one inmate to take his headphones off, so if his housing unit officer needed to page him because he had a visit or needed to go to a hearing, he would be able to hear the page. After Officer Michaels passed this inmate. He stood up and with his curl bar, he began to beat this officer with it. He beat this officer until another officer from 50 to 75 yards away saw the assault take place and responded. By the time he responded, Officer Michaels was almost dead. Had we had staff in the towers, that incident may not have got to where it was. The officer could have fired a warning shot, he could have summoned help, but there was nobody there to help this guy. He was all on his own until somebody could see it. He ended up losing his job, lost his family, lost his home, lost everything he had. It caused medical and mental damage to this guy because we didn't have the opportunity to file any type of a grievance with the state over these issues. This is something that goes on daily. We need some type of conversation with management so we can get this stuff stopped. We're there every day. We're the eyes and the ears. We're on the tier. We're with the inmates. If there's a cell extraction, we go and do it. Who better to bring these issues up to management than us? 2 weeks ago, we had an officer in our chow hall. His throat was cut by an inmate that had been in our general population for 4 hours. He got to his cell. He had just got out of IMU, which is an intensive management unit, because he had been in trouble. He went to his cell. He covered himself with a blanket so his cellie couldn't see what he was doing to alert staff, and he manufactured a weapon. He put a razor blade and a toothbrush, tied it up with some dental floss, went to the chow hall, walked all the way through the line, and when he got close to where the staff member was, he dropped his tray and attacked the staff member, cutting his throat and cutting one of the lieutenants as they responded to help. We need some dialogue. We need some help. I stand in support of Senate Bill 400.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for the panel? Thank you. You can step back. I'm going to go ahead and take the liberty of calling Commissioner Josie, Sheriff Brown, and Farmer Sheriff Burt Wright, since Commissioner Josie's from Tillamook County. I think that's 100 miles, and we'll let you bring your whole panel up. Not to mention the good sheriff is one of my sheriffs, so I want to make sure he gets up here timely. Tim, if you want to start off, or
I'm going last.
Okay, whoever.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Dave Burright. I'm the executive director for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And prior to my assuming this position, I was with the Linn County Sheriff's Office for about 29 years and went up through the ranks at the Sheriff's Office and served as the sheriff for the last 10 and a half years while I was there. I'm here today representing all of Oregon's 36 sheriffs, and we're here urging you to oppose Senate Bill 400. On its face, this bill would appear to be something that everyone should support, and I agree with that. It's on its face, it does seem like that, and I'm there too. The sheriffs are there as well. But you know, perhaps I have the ability to look at this from a number of different perspectives, because not only was I the sheriff and went up through the ranks as a police officer, but I also worked and helped manage the jail. I helped set up and manage a dispatch 911 center. I managed the parole and probation division there at the office for several years. I've not been a firefighter, but we dispatch for a number of them, and I worked very closely with them through my time. So I do have the perspective, I think, of the public safety community. I've been there. The problem with this bill is that the staffing and safety issues will lower the standard to be a potential impact for on-the-job training, and you've heard discussion about that already. Our problem with the bill is the word potential. What does potential mean? Currently, the statute talks that there must be a direct and substantial effect, and we think that's fair. That at least provides some guidelines, some direction as to what should be bargained and what shouldn't. It provides the white lines. At least we ask that people stay between. And if a unit or someone feels that whatever they want to talk about is within that and we disagree, they could also take that to for a decision, and that has happened as well. The problem with it is that the devil is in the details, as usual. because as you've heard, and we agree, all safety issues could be permissible. What is there in the public safety community that, when we do our jobs, does not involve safety? So everything has a possibility of being involved in the safety issue. When you talk to other people, when I talk to other people about this bill, you know, I ask them, you know, with your knowledge of our business, tell me what doesn't have a possible impact on safety or workload. I did this with my wife the other day, prior to another hearing. And, of course, she's been my mate for 30-plus years. Boy, I should have known that one off the top of my head. she's been as much of a police officer, really, all those years as I have, because she's faced it as well. And I ask her, I says, okay, well, tell me, what doesn't have a possible impact? And so she started clicking things off. I'm saying, no, this could be, and she couldn't come up with anything. So there are no provisions. It's wide open. And really that is our issue. There are no boundaries at all to this particular definition. And it's also true, as has been testified before, that we do care about the safety and security of a people that we work with every day. Look at my old position at Linn County. Not only do we have the safety committees that everyone is required to have, but I kept mine separate from the counties. The county had their own at the courthouse. I had a safety committee specific to the sheriff's office because our issues were very different than someone who works in a clerk's office someplace and, you know, not mean to mean them, but a paper cut is a big deal. They're not going into burning buildings. They're not facing people with guns. It's a different issue with our safety committee than it would be with the other staff at the courthouse. But we also had our citizens employee advisory council at the office. And anything and everything could be brought up. And we met regularly, met more often than the safety committee. And the only rule in that committee, in the employee council, was that people respect one another in their opinions. Other than that, they can talk about anything. Anything can come to me. I can take anything to them. I also had a firearms committee. Years ago, we carried the old standard revolvers, and we found that those were not adequate anymore in today's day consequences. And so I brought together my group of individuals who are my local experts there in the office, and I said, I need your help. What is it that we should be carrying? What should we be doing? And they went out and did all the research, worked with their peers, came up with a suggestion, and that's what we implemented. And from then on out, that's exactly who I went to when it came to firearms issues. So I have trouble. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I have trouble when I hear that we can't discuss things. Now, I know every agency is not the same, but certainly you can discuss things. It may mean that you don't get the answer you like, but at least I've never, ever in my experience had an issue where people couldn't come and discuss what was going on. Another problem with this particular bill is that the end product is a zero-sum game. There's been discussion about the cost. And I have a little different philosophy about the cost on this bill, because certainly if an arbitrator decides, and they can, so they will, they can decide that there has to be minimum staffing on a shift or whatever the case may be, the counties, I know, do not have a whole lot of extra money to bring additional people on. I think if you look at your own budget, the state level, the same thing applies there. At the moment, you all are trying very hard to bring the state police back up to 24/7 coverage. But if an arbitrator decides that you have to have more than one trooper within, pick a number, 30 minutes of one another or 15 minutes or whatever the case may be, and this can apply to deputies or city officers as well, I don't really suspect that the legislature will come back in session because of an arbitrator's award and decide to give them more money. So instead, what's going to happen, and it will happen across the board, is that entities will have to take the existing funds they have and rearrange them, which means perhaps there is no graveyard shift in Linn County anymore. or there is no graveyard shift for the state police. Or if you're in the fire service, does it mean that in order to put four people in a, on a particular piece of apparatus instead of three, that we have to close down this fire station and move people to the other one? Again, the bottom line is there will be a loss of service. I don't know how much of a net increase in costs there will be to the public, because I don't think the money's there. So instead, there will be a net loss in service to the people that we're trying to help. You know, I told you I came up through the ranks, and years ago, I very, very clearly remember a number of times when I was working graveyard shift as a patrol deputy in Linn County, and there were supposed to be three of us on duty for all of rural Linn County. And yet, on these particular nights I'm referring to, we had one person off sick, one on vacation, and that left me for all of 2,300 square miles. But you know, there were only two options that I had on those nights. The first option was to sit in the courthouse, and when the telephone rang and somebody says, I've just had a car crash, or my house is being broken into, or someone's attacking me, I say, I can't come because there's only one of me. Or the other option is I went out and did the job the best I could, knowing that it wasn't the best situation in the world, but knowing that my dispatcher kept track of me, and also knowing the sheriff didn't like it either, but there were no other options because there wasn't any other money. There was nobody else to call out. And I think if we aren't careful, that's exactly where we end up in Oregon when it comes to this kind of situation. I'm not particularly happy with the way the bargaining situation is going now. I know that there's been discussion here about, you know, the arbitrator's rulings, but it's my understanding that in the last couple of years, the overall, the vast, vast majority of the decisions have been going to labor. So I'm not sure what's broken from their side in this case. I think if they need to, if they don't feel they're being fairly taken care of, that they ought to be taking that to that unit. And what my personal feeling is, this is not something that should be handled piecemeal. That if this is, you know, if the situation is broken, then we need to fix it. But let's not do it a piece at a time. Let's not do it with Senate Bill 400 or 401 or 402. Which, by the way, you heard the argument that the reason that 400 is okay is because of the last best offer and taking the best interest of the public into account, then you have to consider what other services a local government might provide, but those bills take that away. So it makes me a little concerned about where this might all head in the end. So speaking on behalf of the sheriffs, we urge you to not pass this bill. Thank you.
Sheriff. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your time, and I know that you will keep open minds while we have this discussion and receive these comments in the spirit they're intended. And I hope the union does the same. In fact, there's union members here who I have rallied behind on issues before, and I have no problem with the union. I have a great relationship with my working unit. But the fact is,
Sheriff Brown, just for the record, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, yes, sir. Chris Brown.
Thank you.
This meeting really isn't about the unions, and it really isn't about management. The folks at this meeting is about aren't in the room, and the fact is the consequences of this decision will impact people from Astoria to Ontario and the Dalles to Klamath Falls. As Dave said, this is really about the citizens and the service that we are able to provide. Dave covered it pretty eloquently, a number of the things I wanted to talk about, but I'll just touch a couple issues. First, one of the things I heard during the prior gentleman's testimony was a suggestion that these discussions don't take place, and all they're asking for is a forum to have these discussions. And I can tell you that these discussions take place every day, all the time, and we take these discussions very seriously. In fact, many times we are the ones that initiate improvements and changes in our safety protocols and equipment and resources. Currently, important issues are discussed with the union and with management. They're prioritized,
And we make decisions, and we make meaningful decisions on meaningful topics. If this becomes a entitlement for the union, and if the union begins to use this routinely as a leverage mechanism, then they will present a smorgasbord of issues, and the discussion is diminished. The quality of the discussion is diminished. And the issues become very convoluted, and we lose that sense of priority. I look forward to having these discussions with my association, and I think the very fact that we are not compelled by process to do this builds a trust relationship and actually helps us in our relationship. We're able to do positive things together because we want to, and not because we have to. I also think that we need to differentiate between instances of poor management, the inherent dangers of this job, and things that are appropriate for collective bargaining. The fact is, and Dave alluded to that, a lot of what we do is dangerous stuff. And no matter what we do, and no matter how much equipment, how much armor, and how much stuff we have, sometimes we get hurt. And sometimes we get hurt badly or killed. I also wanted to share with you a little bit about my background. I started in New York walking the beat. I came to Oregon. I've worked patrol. I've worked undercover narcotics and organized crime, Colombian, Mexican organizations. I have driven a patrol car up and down Highway 101 when after 2 o'clock in the morning I was the only cop in the county. And I understand what it's like to be alone, and I understand what it's like to be scared and to not have the tools and things that I felt I should have. But the fact of the matter is they just couldn't afford to provide me with more. I also have been involved in 5 incidents that resulted in either the cop getting shot or the bad guy getting shot or both getting shot. My sister was killed in the line of duty in Oregon a few years ago. And so I understand the consequences of the dangers of the job, and I understand the importance of the conversation. And again, we have this conversation all the time. The fact is, I've been a union member, and I can tell you from personal experience that I did not have the necessary holistic understanding to make prudent judgments on strategic issues like staffing and deployment and those kinds of things. My perspective was narrow, it was tactical, and generally based on how things affected me, how things appeared to me. My staffing opinions from a line perspective would not have served the community well at that time, and I understand that now. But most importantly, I think what I wanted to share with the committee is this. In Douglas County, our ONC revenues for fiscal year 06-07 were $25 million. If the safety net is not reauthorized, that means there's $25 million off the table. Public safety, my department, currently gets every dime of the property taxes collected in Douglas County. But this amounts up to only 44.8% of my budget. The loss of ONC funds to the sheriff's office after discounting funding from external sources will create a vacuum of about 40%. And that's making the assumption that the commissioners are not going to divert some of that property tax money to other places. So, in theory, I may lose as much as 50% of my department, and that's somewhere between 80 and 90 people. My county is a little larger than the size of Connecticut. And it's not easy to police with the folks we have. As Dave said, there is no fallback position for the citizens. There aren't any troopers out there anymore. And the thing that I hope you recognize and that I hope you consider strongly is that the safety net thing is not, you know, just a discussion in the newspapers. We are about to hit the wall. Theoretically, I may lose 100 people from my department. The state police in Roseburg have gone from 28 troopers when I was there to less than 10. There is no troopers to backfill. Everything we do together. And if there are any costs that result from any bills or legislation like this, it is just throwing fire, fuel on the fire, And the end result is going to be that the bargaining units in my county get smaller. Because, as Dave said, we can staff one shift, however we're directed to staff it, but then we won't have a swing shift, and we won't have a graveyard, and the people won't have anybody to come. And the folks down there and I don't care if it's a blue uniform that answers the radio or if it's a brown uniform or what color it is, as long as somebody goes. And we work together, and we go together, and we cooperate on everything. We can't afford this, and we can't afford any more draconian cuts and effects to our budget, or we just won't be there anymore. So I implore you to not support this bill. That's the wrong bill at the wrong time. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tim Josie. I'm a Tillamook County Commissioner, recovering legislator. Three of you I had the honor and privilege to serve with. It's a pleasure to be here in front of you. The appropriate ones are grinning. The lucky ones aren't. I'd like to take off. I'm the past president of the Association of Oregon Counties, so I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here representing Tillamook County, and then just as importantly, I'm here representing Sheriff Todd Anderson, Tillamook County Sheriff, who's in the back of the room. He won't be speaking today. This is an issue that's very important to him. I want to take off and speak on the theme that you just listened to. There will be cost to the counties. We just don't know what it is, and I think that over time it'll escalate as time goes by, every time there is an arbitrator and there's a decision that works against us. It'll reverberate across the state and hit every jurisdiction, and so I think as time goes by, the cost will just get greater. And it just couldn't come at a worse time. When I look at our sheriff parole and probation budget, it constitutes 30% of our general fund budget. And it's about 95% of our discretionary funds. Everything else is pretty much locked in. As you know, counties are agents of the state, and we are mandated to provide services. Many of those services we just can't do without. And so where would we go? And in this case, in Tillamook County's case, if we're looking at sizable cuts, we're going to have to go to the sheriff's department. Our sheriff's department budget at 30%, which includes, as I said, probation and parole, is one of the lowest in the state. And I think the reason for that is because we're one of the poorest counties in the state. We just don't have the funds to provide the type of services that the sheriff department really needs as it is. And so this is going to add some additional burden to us if this thing passes. And if it does pass, we're going to have to do one of two things. We're either going to have to cut patrol deputies. We already don't, as I said, don't have enough patrol deputies on the highway as it is. Or we're going to have to cut budgets somewhere else. I don't know where we would make those cuts. I've spent 8 years now as a county commissioner poring over our budget trying to figure out where we could make cuts. I can't think of one place where we could make a cut without having huge impacts for the services that they provide. Counties are already hurting because of ballot measure 5, which passed in 1991 and 1995. We had measure 47, which turned into measure 50, and that's the one that really hurts us. Cities and counties across the state have been in the process of a slow train wreck because of that, because what happened is it locks Measure 50 locks in our property tax rates. Tillamook County's property tax rate is just a little bit under $1.50 a thousand. It's one of the lowest in the state. That's because we receive timber revenues. Incidentally, our state timber revenues will be going down a little over $500,000 this year, which exacerbates our situation. And then the second thing, the ballot measure our Measure 50 did is it only allows taxes, the assessed value, to go up 3% a year, period. Even if the real market value goes up more than that, your assessed value can only go up 3% a year. Well, if you, counties and cities are in a business of providing services, and which means personnel costs, and if you look at personnel costs, and you folks know what that's like, because with the PERS issue that you've dealt with, it's more than 3% a year. And so the train wreck has been coming for some time. Now with PL 106393, the safety net legislation hitting us, the train wreck is right at our doorstep. For us, the big train wreck is with our road department. It's going to cut our road funding in half. And we were already underfunded to the tune of about $500,000 a year. And so, we receive O&C funds that go into our general fund, and that's about $600,000 a year. We're going to have to find that. And Sheriff Todd Anderson already knows where the discretionary funds are, and we're going to do everything we can to keep him whole. All this does is make things so much worse for us. And the last thing that I'll say is there are some counties that are on the verge of bankruptcy, and will no longer be able to be counties because they, once they make the cuts and balance their budget because of the lack of the safety net legislation, they're gonna be in a position where they can't even function as a county. So they're going to go out of business. That means that you folks are going to have to take over their services. One of the services you're going to have to take over is 1145. And if this gets too expensive, more and more counties will have to look at turning back 1145 community corrections. And I can tell you, we perform that function cheaper than what you folks can. And so if we end up having to turn that thing back, then this issue becomes your issue. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions, and we'll start with Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, you were on this side of the dais in 95 when Senate Bill 50 passed, correct?
Correct.
I wasn't in the process then. But obviously something was going on in 95 that brought this issue to the forefront. And I was wondering if you could give us a little historical perspective about that. If I listened to what Mr. Livingston said, that everything was good before 95, this could be talked about. Yet in 95, Senate Bill 750, something brought it forward, and this was part of it. Could you give us some historical perspective of, maybe you weren't part of those discussions. I don't know. But
you should be careful with the questions you ask, Senator. I'm a Democrat, and I'm going to give you my biased opinion on what happened. First of all, I have a great deal of disregard for the initiative process the way it is, because it's direct democracy and people put together initiatives, and Bill Sizemore was the one that brought us this one. They put it together at the kitchen table, and it took all session long to fix Measure 47 and ship it back to the voters in a legal format.
That was 97.
No, that was 95.
Well, I was here for that discussion.
That was 40. That's what you're talking about is Measure 47, right?
No, I'm talking about Senate Bill
750 and 95, when Dale Bryant was the one of the main players in that.
Oh,
I'll help your memory.
You'd have to remind me what that's about. I remember
that's the tort reform. That's the one.
Well, yeah, 750 is what gave us the law we have today.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I wasn't involved in that, okay. So I can't comment.
Is that it?
I just want to get
that historical perspective. Thank you. So I do have a few questions. I'm not trying to put anyone on the spot here, but I am interested in getting some information on this. And I guess really what I wanted to start off with, and Dave, I guess for you, since you're with the association.
Mr. Chair, before you get started, I have a meeting in Manzanita at 6 o'clock. Would you excuse me?
I have a couple questions I was going to ask you too, Tim. So,
oh, the prosecuting attorney.
Not quite yet. Okay. So, Dave, I guess the thing is, there was a packet that I provided to the Sheriff's Association regarding 750 and 321, which was the bill 2 years ago. Anna Braun, who's our committee administrator, was also the administrator there. She provided a lot of information. I've not heard back from the association as to whether or not there's any additional information that could be gleaned from what has happened with arbitrations and stuff, because I'll just share with you that before, and this is notes that Anna provided for the committee last year for me as the chair, before 750, the safety issues were treated as other conditions of employment, and the Employment Relations Board used a two-part balancing test to determine whether a safety proposal was mandatory or permissive for bargaining. And then she's put together an attachment A that goes through some of that information on background. And then what we know is that when 750 passed in 1995, and just for the record, myself, Senator Gordley, and then Representative Josie were all House members, we all voted no. This was a measure that was tort reform, and if I remember correctly, we had little to no input on this. This was a package that was rolled out toward the end, and we basically had no discussion or no part, and it just happened. So that's, you know, just go ahead and set the record. But when 750 passed, it basically said that at that point, the safety and staffing issues were not included in the definition of employment relations and therefore were no longer a mandatory bargaining issue unless they have a direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees, which is where we're at today. And so it seems to me that we've lost that opportunity because And Dave, I'm not really asking you to give me an answer now. I think that you probably need to check and see whatever happened as to what discussions took place, if any, regarding that packet. I know that your representative was appreciative of getting the packet from what he told me, and I'm not sure whatever came of that. But what I know is that there is a difference as to when safety is allowed to be discussed. Currently, it can be discussed at a safety panel. There's no obligation that it's discussed at the bargaining table. And that's what I see this bill to do, is to actually get us back to where we were pre-95 to allow for those discussions if they allow those discussions to come forward if they, in fact, have a potential impact on safety. And knowing how the decisions have come down, and her research showed over a 10-year period that all the arbitrations that took place, and I'll just read to you the notes, so this is part of the stuff I believe I handed to your group, that there were 72 cases that were found on the website. There were two cases that that she thought dealt with safety in a substantial way, and only after a review she determined that those were not actually even on safety. So it appears that since 1995, matters that have gone before the arbitration have not included safety, and I assume that's because it's discretionary at this point, and if management says we're not going to discuss it, it's completely off the table, and so there's no way for that to ever be addressed. I'm looking for a balance to try to get something back on the table, and I am convinced from my perspective 2 years ago, and unless the Sheriff's Association or some other management group can show me where I'm wrong, the current process that we have for setting up an arbitration, there has never been a decision has been made at the first tier, which is where the interest and welfare of the public would outweigh the other criteria. They've always dropped below that, the arbitrators, and have balanced through there, and at no time has management lost on an issue that they couldn't afford. At least that's the research I have. And so I hope, Tim, you're wrong. I hope, Chris, that Congress will, in fact, live up to their obligations and actually pass the safety net. I mean, that's, to me, an obligation when 54% of this land is federally owned and operated. We should have some type of, they have a responsibility to fulfill their part. But if that should happen, it seems like it would make the case even that much more difficult for the labor side to come in and try to argue for something on a safety matter when you start looking at the balancing, because if the funds aren't there, it's even going to be more of a dire stretch for the arbitrator to go there if they were going to go there in the first place. So these are the concerns I have as chair sitting here today, and I hope that we can have ongoing communications and dialogue to fill these out, because I want to make sure that everyone can work in a safe environment, that we can in fact have the discussions, and that they can in fact occur if necessary at the bargaining table and not be excluded to only being at a safety panel, where they can either in a good shop be taken forward or in a bad shop just dropped. And so I think those are issues I'm dealing with, and I hope that through this process that we will have more dialogue to answer some of the questions I brought forward.
Chairman Brzezinski, I absolutely agree with you, and I appreciate the chance to speak with you more, our association with you more. I happen to have your reply. It was very comprehensive. And I am not an expert on the technicalities of labor law. I wouldn't even pretend to be that way.
And I'm not either.
We have others that can help us with, so we'll be glad to work with you to answer any questions that you have. In my very limited knowledge of it, the only thing I know, I've been told that interest arbitrations decided since 1995 until about mid-2005 were pretty much split half and half between labor and management. So it seemed to be working pretty good. But what I'm told that since that time, though, 9 of the last 10, at least, interest arbitration decisions were won by labor. Yeah. So I don't, I don't know what that means. Is that, it raises an interesting question. And then I also don't know whether there's been any challenges to any safety issues that have been brought up to decide whether they really were, did they provide a substantial impact. At the last hearing I was at, there was some reference made to one, but I don't know the details behind it. But I understood from the discussion that there had been, and the ruling had gone in favor of labor. But I could be wrong.
Okay. And I don't know, for the last 2 years, I've asked Anna to do an update for the last 2 years so we can supplement what we have, both
Great.
Of us now, so we can kind of see. And I guess the last thing I had, and Tim, this is really for you, one of the statements that you made. Basically, just the simple passage of this bill, I understood your testimony. You felt that it would require cuts and or readjustments of existing budgets. And to me, I'm not sure just the passage of this bill would only allow in the future, when it comes down to collective bargaining time, to potentially have the requirement of both sides to bargain safety at the table. And so I'm not sure, did I miss something or misunderstand your testimony as to how this bill's simple passage would cause your county to have to cut budgets?
No, I think you and I are in agreement. I would phrase it a little bit differently. I mean, there wouldn't be immediate cuts, quite obviously, because we really can't quantify what the cost would be, and the cost would be established over time. And so the cuts would be the expenses and possible cuts would be something that would be realized over time.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else, gentlemen? Anything from the panel? Thank you very, very much for being here today.
Drive safely.
Slowly. Yeah, and slowly. Don't go through Coburg. All right. Sorry. Brian? And who else? I want to get a panel up here so we can move people and not have that much time. Let's see. I'm going to go ahead and ask Randy Davis. Well, it looks like we got another panel of four people. So if Randy or Davis is here, or Jim Walker, one of the two, one of you two come up here, then I can take the other three, and we'll alternate with another set from opposition after this.
Excuse me, Chairman. Is this an opposition statement?
No, it is not.
Okay.
No, that's next.
You should have known. Say next to me that that was not the case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which is basically the worker bees that are out doing these issues, driving the streets, working in correctional facilities, community corrections, parole and probation. I represent about 6,000 of those people that actually are doing the jobs that we're talking about today. I have today here in the room representatives from Tigard, Portland, Gresham, Marion County, Salem, Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, Oregon State Police Officers Association, and Clackamas County. These are the folks that could not wear their uniforms today because they're barred from wearing their uniforms. But that's another issue. I have another bill on that.
We can hardly wait.
Yes. If you want to tell you about it today, I can, but I'll hold that back for the bill. I'm going to attempt to not touch on all the things you've heard before, but respond actually to a couple of comments that I heard and also the comments from the chair. When the opposition, in this particular case, Dave Burright talks about the balance of the arbitrations historically, what they fail to understand or portray to you is that the arbitrations, if they come out even, don't include safety. If we included safety, in our final last best, then we automatically lose the arbitration. It would not be 50-50, 60-40. It would be 0 to 100. That's what we're talking about. That's the issue here. The second thing that I'd like to respond to is this portrayal that 750 somehow was this long dialogue with all the parties involved. Mr. Chair, you talked a little bit about that. I did not represent public safety officers at the time. I came on the next session after 750. But I can tell you from talking to them, they were never a part of that dialogue at all. They were entirely left out of that balancing act on 750 that is portrayed as this long dialogue and how we got to 750, and it was this new era of bargaining and management and labor all worked through their issues and so forth. That never occurred from our side. That was not a part of the discussion. I do have some written testimony that I will hand out, but let me just touch on a couple of quick points. You've heard the option. And the options, there's two options here. Is you either do a statewide standard in which there is absolutely no flexibility at all, or you do it jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And the method of this body has established for jurisdiction by jurisdiction flexibility is collective bargaining. There is no other option at the local level. You've heard safety committees, well, that recommendation doesn't have to go to the bargaining table. You've heard all about that. We have intentionally made the determination that we did not want to have statewide standards because the city of Riddle is not the same as the city of Portland, and their needs, desires of both labor and management and their citizens are vastly different. That's why you have collective bargaining at the local level rather than statewide standards for this. Let me also say that in this hearing and the hearing that happened on the House side, we heard from a number of the employers saying that safety is job one. Well, I commend those folks. These are not the employers that this bill is aimed at. If, in fact, they have discussions, they allow an open dialogue about safety issues at the collective bargaining table and lower, all the way up. This has absolutely no impact on them at all. It has an impact only on those employers that refuse to talk about safety issues. So let's focus on that. Again, you heard that a small percentage of the bargaining process in final last best goes to arbitration. It's about 10%, as you heard. You've also heard or will hear about these arbiters not knowing the needs of the local communities, what they need to have. In fact, they may even be an out-of-state arbiter. As you've heard from the question from Senator Monroe, both sides get the opportunity to funnel that down to an arbiter that's satisfactory to both sides. And if the needs of the local community are not being addressed by the arbiter, I would submit to you that that's partly the responsibility of local government not making their points as far as their ability to pay and what the needs of those communities are. They have the ability to do that under the statute. For us, and I'll end on this, for police officers, different than firefighters, the issues for us may be as basic as a vest. It may be as basic as what kind of a firearm you're going to use. It could be as minimal as a Crown Vic, which is the historic police cruiser, which has shown some evidence of in rear-end collisions explosion danger. There's a case in Arizona, a pretty highly publicized case in Arizona, that occurred. There is a retrofit to that. We are now phasing out of Crown Vics. They're not going to be made anymore. But we have a lot of Crown Vics out there. And if the officers in a particular jurisdiction believe that is important to them, they should have the ability to bring that up.
I want to ask you to kind of summarize, because we're kind of getting late, and I want to make sure we get other testimony in, please.
Yeah. That was my last point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your time. If you'll give us your name.
My name is Randy Davis. I work at the Oregon State Hospital as a mental health therapist. I was wondering on your list if you showed Jim Walker, because he was going to testify with me.
Yes, I've got Jim Walker and Roy Carter, and then looks like L. Ray Sampson. They were all together, but I couldn't take all four at once.
Well, I just take Jim Walker is going to from the state hospital if I could.
Mr. Walker, why don't you come on up, and Mr. Davis, if you'll go ahead and get started.
Like I said, Mr. Chair, my name is Randy Davis. I'm a member of SEIU Local 503, and I work at the Oregon State Hospital as a mental health therapist in the men's maximum security admission ward. And I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 400. Currently, the inability at the bargaining table just to talk about staffing issues causes forces the hand of everyone who works at the state hospital to compromise between their individual safety and the safety of the patients, compared to not being able to talk about it where we wouldn't have to compromise those issues. So one of the things that I could just reiterate a lot of things that are said, but one of the big issues for us is in a large institution is that when we go to discuss safety issues with the management, those issues automatically get shelved. When we talk about how many people it will take care of people, it gets shelved. So, no, we're not going to talk about staffing issues, says the management at the state hospital. So, henceforth, over years, they've put this, we don't want to talk about staffing and safety issues aside. And so what happened eventually was it got taken out of our hands, and fortunately enough for a lot of people at the state hospital, there were a number of patients who sought and obtained legal counsel and sued the state of Oregon. And the next thing you know, a biting lawsuit comes along, and there's more staff at the hospital. And for years we've been saying, if you would just talk to us, we could have told you we need more bodies to help these people so people don't get injured, so the patients don't get injured and their staff don't get injured. And they still to this day say, well, staffing is not really an issue for us at bargaining. Maybe you should talk to the legislatures about that. So we've done that over time, and the hospital still has increased the staffing. And luckily for us, a lawsuit came along. So for us, collective bargaining now has become biting and finding people to bite our case in the courts so we can get more people to take care of individuals. I would hate to see this as the precedent set for all of the, you know, law enforcement and firefighters throughout the state of Oregon to have to seek their victims saying, my house wouldn't have burnt down if there would have been another firefighter there, or, you know, a buying lawsuit against the county because they don't have enough county, you know, police officers because, well, we want to talk about safety. Or whether or not their police car broke down on the way to get there because, well, that was a safety issue, but we're not going to talk about it at bargaining. I know I make light of this, but this is, in actuality, how it happens. Only it comes more sternly. That's not an issue of collective bargaining. Can we move on to something else? And that's how it gets faced with us. So I just want to speak in support of Senate Bill 400. Let you know that we don't want to see the courts become collective bargaining. We want to be able to sit down with our managers and have open discussions about how to keep the people of Oregon safe. And for us at the state hospital, it's the most fragile of Oregon's people to keep safe and the people who take the time to take care of them.
Thank you. Mr. Walker.
Yeah, my name is Jim Walker, and I work at the state hospital. I'm the vice president of the local union there, 392. I've been there 19 years. I'm a mental health therapy coordinator. Currently, one of my jobs is to supply staffing, so I'm kind of front and center on this issue. I deal with staffing issues every day, and the lack of staffing, really. We have a word there that's called two words, minimum staffing, which means what can you get by with for that day. So that means, in the same respect, what can you get by for treatment that day? So the patients are given cut-cost treatment. Staffing levels are low. Personally, what does that mean? I'm going to give you just a real quick story. 2 days ago, within 15 minutes, I had two patients that went down to the hospital. And one of them was a one-to-one. He was dying of cancer. And his situation got a lot worse. The second one developed ammonia, and he had to be taken off his meds because they were complicating it. So he was going to be a two-to-one because he's a manic, and strong chance that he would become manic down there. So we, within 15 minutes, I went from I need 5 staff to 8 staff, and they'll be staying out at the hospital watching these individuals. I have to staff for maybe a week of this, and we're already low staffed, so that means another word comes into play, two words, mandatory. Mandatory overtime, so you have to stay. To compare this, it would be like Everybody here has to go do another committee after this for another 8 hours. It changes lives. Me, I'm a single dad. I have four girls at home. I go home every night except the nights that I get mandatoried, and that's not unusual. We run probably at the hospital 10 to 30 overtimes in one night. If I get mandated, I get paid $30 an hour to sit and watch someone. That's a lot of money. If you had two people that are new in new positions, they get paid $12 to $14 an hour. It doesn't take a lot to figure out that this is wrong. Okay, I'm going to move on. We talked about safety. We have a committee going at the hospital now that is for difficult clients, which is another word for saying they're assaultive. Repeat assaulters. We had a real problem with this, and we still do. It's ongoing. The committee is chaired by a manager, and he's not really willing to deal with the aggressive part of the subject matter. And that's what really is at the heart of this committee, is what can we do with these individuals that are assaulting staff? What he'll deal with is, how are you going to take care of staff after they've been assaulted? It's ridiculous. You're willing to take care of your people after you've been assaulted, but not look at why they're getting assaulted. We don't have a voice. We need a voice to say, you know, this ain't safe. That's what we're really about with this SB 400. We want a voice. One of the gentlemen talked about Central Safety Committee. Being the vice president, I am a member of that group at the state hospital, and I brought up the fact that people are being assaulted and what can we do as a committee there to help. And the chairman, who is a manager, and it's pretty much all managers except for me, uniformly said, we don't do that here in the Central Safety Committee, so the doors are being shut on us.
Mr. Walker, I want to ask you to summarize, if you have anything else.
My summary would be that I really want a voice. This isn't about money. This is about us saying, you know, it's only fair that we be able to give our position, and I'm in support of this SB 400 strongly.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you. I'm going to now call up Bob Austin and Steve Bryant. We'll follow that up with the two chiefs.
Okay. Go ahead. Chairman Prusansky, Senate Commerce Committee members, I'm glad to be here this afternoon. My name is Bob Austin. I'm the mayor of the city of Estacada, and also this year's president of the League of Oregon Cities, representing all 242 cities across this state. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be able to address this bill. We have similar issues for bills 401 and 402, but we'll stick with 400. I'll try to be as brief as possible. You have copies of my testimony and one attachment. So one might ask, why would mayor, city council, city managers, police and fire chiefs, and other public employers be so concerned about public safety, collective bargaining? And I think we're all interested in the same thing. We're trying to give the highest possible priority to public safety in our communities, and we're trying to protect the safety of our employees. So we're looking for the best balance that we can, and it's always good to look at the bottom line and follow the budget in terms of how we've been able to try to achieve that balance. We've done some research recently. We've got information from 65 cities responded to a survey. We've got about 60% of them reporting that they're now spending more on police and fire services than they actually receive in total property taxes. And so I'll speak to that in a little bit in terms of our revenue sources being really, really limited. Measures 5 and 50 in particular basically limits the ability of our municipalities to go out and raise additional revenue. We're just really, really tight. So just some examples. Some of the cities included Corvallis, Dallas, Gladstone, Ashland, and Burns. And in each of those cases, looking at starting from 1995 going up to 2007, Most of the percentages go from 85% or so of city property tax collections to 100% or even greater. So the information is in my handout. But even in my city, city of Estacada, we have the fire district that provides protection for a larger area around the city. I spoke to the chief this morning, and he has similar concerns in terms of being able to adequately protect the citizenry and being able to pay for all those services at the same time, trying to achieve that balance. For our police protection in our city, we do contract with the county sheriff's office, and they supply those services for us. And our costs have gone up and have continued to increase. In fact, we're not even at 100% 24-hour coverage. In the last 2 years, we've had to cut back our hours of service to our community, and we're almost at 100% in terms of using up all of our available property tax to pay for that service. So it is an increasing issue for not just my little community, but for others across the state. And again, it's mostly the issue of our revenue sources are really limited. We depend upon franchise fees as well. In my community, I know the last time we dealt with police services, we set up a committee. We probably talked about it for a good 6 months, and we had to actually cut back on our service. So that was a sad thing for us to do, but we didn't have much choice. I think the League of Oregon Cities understands that there's a dynamic that has been heavily influenced by the recent trend in interest arbitration awards. That's the primary reason that we're so concerned about this bill and the other two that will be taken up soon. We've got some data attached, the nice little color bar graphs, and that's mostly from three cities that have unions representing the International Association of Firefighters, a local police association, AFSCME, and non-represented employees. So we looked at this history for periods between 1997 and 2006. And during that time, the CPA increased about 28% versus salaries going up roughly 50%. So the CPI, basically salaries outpacing CPI. For police associations, the average increase was 37%. For AFSCME, it was 35%. And for non-represented employees, it was 32%. So quite a big jump. So if we're to look at all of the compensation, fringe benefits, everything else, we believe the separation or pattern of separation from the CPI would probably even be more dramatic. So we're continuing to research this kind of information.
Yes.
I know you're very short on time, and I won't ask many questions, but just because it pertains directly to what you're saying. There's a lot of testimony with respect to the increased cost that this provides. I haven't heard anybody say why. And I wonder if you would just capsulize, as you're talking about your costs, why the provision in this bill is going to increase your expenses.
Okay. Well, if I could, Mr. Chairman, complete my testimony, Steve Bryant, our main lobbyist, is ready with that kind of information, more
very
details,
well.
If that would be.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Appropriate. Okay, so really, I guess we don't see this as an issue about employee safety. Rather, it's more of a way of finding the sustainable way to match available resources with the expenditures in terms of the trend for public safety. So we're always trying to find that balance, and we've been struggling with that as our pattern of information shows. We are doing some still additional research, and we can even provide more information, and Steve can refer to that. But essentially, we don't see it as a local problem. If there are real problems with local governments not taking employee safety seriously, we ask that you give us an opportunity to address those problems outside of the binding arbitration arena. So I'd like to thank you for your interest in listening to us, and if I can be of assistance or any of our staff from the League of Oregon Cities, please let us know.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bryant.
Yes, my name is Steve Bryant, and I'm the interim legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. Prior to this time, I served as city manager for the city of Albany for many years. I hope I can address some of the questions that have been raised today and offer at least an idea for a potential solution that we'd like you to consider. First, I did notice in the correspondence from Mayor Austin a typo that I should have caught for him, and I want you to correct that in the fourth paragraph where it says in 1995. That should be 2005. We looked at 3 years' worth of data starting in 2005, so these increases in public safety costs are just over the last 3 years, not over the last 12 years. So I needed to correct that for the record and hope that that's noted. For purposes of this discussion, I'd like us to focus on four terms as used in this bill, and I'll get to the issue of why we're concerned that, given the meaning of these terms, it will have an increase in cost to local government. Those terms are potential, staffing levels, safety issues, and workload. And I'd like to just spend a moment on each one of those terms. You've heard some discussion about the term potential. And our concern there is that it is simply too far a leap to go from what is the current standard, where we must bargain over safety issues that have a direct and substantial effect on worker on-the-job safety, to potential safety issue. That leap really brings to the bargaining table a whole array of issues that we believe will bog down the collective bargaining process, which already is quite lengthy and expensive, and make it much more cumbersome. I'll get back into that when we talk about safety issues, but the term potential is problematic. The second term, staffing levels. You've not heard a lot of testimony about that. You just heard some from some state workers. We think that a significant impetus for this language is so that the unions can talk about staffing levels at the bargaining table. And to us, that means the minimum number of firefighters on a shift, or the minimum number of firefighters that you staff an engine company with. Could be the minimum number of police officers on a shift or in a vehicle. There's a whole host of staffing issues that could be brought to the bargaining table that if it goes into a final last best offer and if an arbiter awards a union proposal that has minimum staffing levels in it, that standard can become the standard against which other cities are measured when it comes time to looking at the comparables that are also specified in statute. So if I put on my hat as the city manager in Albany and we compare against Springfield, and a Springfield decision said that we need four-person minimums on a fire crew, that would have reverberation effects throughout the state. So we're concerned about that term, staffing levels, and how that might be interpreted by future arbitration awards. We ask you to think about that in terms of putting on your hat as policymakers for the state of Oregon. As soon as staffing levels are inserted into the list of mandatory bargaining subjects, arbiters will be asked to look at Oregon staffing ratios for corrections and state police by looking at what happens in your comparators. Your comparators for state of Oregon corrections and state police will be other states. Well, all you have to do is look at Oregon's ranking in terms of state police, and you know, of course, you're very much understaffed in state police. So I think that should be a concern to you. It will have a rising tide effect for all of us in terms of how minimum staffing levels are considered. Third, the term safety. You've heard it said that we take safety very seriously at the local level. I don't think I need to emphasize that anymore. I would like to impress upon you that it is a good management practice, and there probably is a difference between good managers and managers that aren't so good in terms of looking at safety issues. I would submit to you that most of the testimony that you have heard has dealt with problems at the state level. And if there is a problem at the state level, I suggest that there are other ways to address safety concerns in state corrections and state hospital than inserting this level that will affect all of us at the local government level in ways that go beyond what we can even anticipate. Again, the current standard of direct and substantial effect on the-job safety is a standard that we understand, and I guess I would submit that if the plain interpretation of the English language isn't sufficient to direct arbiters, we ought to focus on that language and see if there's a better term that can be used. Fourth, the insertion of the term workload. That's an entirely new and particularly burdensome topic for collective bargaining discussions. That's on line 23, page 2 of the bill. That's a new item that's inserted in there that's been, I think, completely ignored in the testimony so far. And you can imagine what would happen when an employee wants to grieve over the fact that their workload has been increased. And we have to submit that interpretation of that language for arbitration. It opens the door to a whole new realm of arbitrations that we've not dealt with previously. The unions have submitted testimony, I don't know if it's in writing before you now, it was on the House side, that similar language is in effect in nearly half of the other states without dire consequences. We've examined the statutes in several of those states and can find no similar language in those states that we've examined. In fact, our current executive director comes from the state of Minnesota, which is one of the states that's cited by the unions as a state that has similar language. And in fact, Minnesota has language that says a public employer is not required to meet and negotiate on matters of inherent managerial policy. Goes on to list examples, including the number of personnel. So Minnesota precludes staffing levels from their collective bargaining discussion. I can cite several other examples of states, but I won't spend any more time on that. I would be happy to provide more research to contradict that evidence if it becomes an issue for you as to how Oregon compares with other states. We think Oregon compares quite favorably for labor, and we need go no further. So the bill simply goes too far, and what I would submit as a potential solution is that we have no concern about talking about safety issues at the bargaining table. Our concern is submitting those for the final last best offer in the binding arbitration process. If the committee were interested in language, amendment language, that would require that we meet and confer on safety issues, we would be happy to provide you with that language, as long as it were separated out from the binding arbitration process. It would be language that would say that we're required to meet when either side brings a safety issue for discussion. It would trigger a meet and confer process, and we would be required to sit down and talk about safety issues. We think that happens at the local level. I can't speak to the extent that it happens at the state level. It sounds to me like there's a problem that needs to be addressed for the state institutions, and we'd be happy to work with you on potential solutions to that. So thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions or offer any assistance that we can provide.
Any questions for the panel? Mr. Bryant, I guess one thing I want to flesh out is your last statement. Let's say the panel or the committee did in fact say we wanted that language. We put it in, and if it's not going to be in the final best offer, what would be the end result of having the two sides sit down and discuss it at the bargaining table?
Mr. Chair, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, I think our intent is to essentially offer a solution to the complaint that's been raised here several times, that when we raise safety issues, management simply says, we're not going to talk about that. That's not a mandatory subject of bargaining. We want to say, okay, let's mandate it. Let's mandate it as a subject of bargaining, just not require that it go to binding arbitration. What we're trying to say there is that managers at all levels of government should take safety seriously. We think we're doing that at the local level. We're hearing that it's not happening and that unions are trying to raise legitimate concerns and are simply not being heard. We want those issues to be heard. We think it's in the state's best interest. We think it's in local government's best interest to have good dialogue with our employees over their safety concerns. So if there's a way that we need to codify that, we'd be happy to help with that. We're just not willing to go to binding arbitration on those issues.
All right. Any other questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen. Chief Adams and Chief Groves. And committee members, we're right close to the time of where we're supposed to schedule a stop. I know that some of you may have other commitments. If you do, feel free to leave.
and we're just basically taking testimony at this point and don't feel obligated to stay knowing that you have other commitments.
Chuck Brzezanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chief Mark Adams of the Kaiser Police Department. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to oppose Senate Bill 400. Our reasons for opposing Senate Bill 400 are simple. Oregon law currently provides for binding arbitration to resolve labor management issues for critical public safety personnel. When there is a direct, substantial safety issue that cannot be resolved, the issue is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Okay? However, in my 27-plus years as a police officer in Oregon, I've never been to the bargaining table over a safety issue. I've spent half my career as a member of and often a president of a police union, second half of my career as a police manager. And I've racked my brain, and in every case, issues of safety have been handled promptly and fairly without the need for labor attorneys or arbitrators. Over the course of my career, I have witnessed hundreds of changes in equipment, procedures, and policies regarding safety and staffing. And I can provide a number of examples, including the transition from a six-shot revolver to a high-capacity semi-automatic pistols, wooden batons to collapsible metal batons, mace to pepper spray, saps to tasers, police hats to ball caps, improved use of force and defensive tactics training and policies, retrofits to those Crown Vics, shotguns to long rifles, and the list goes on and on. None of those we ever had to go to the bargaining table over. Ballistic vests. Early in my career, officers weren't provided ballistic vests. Today, all officers wear ballistic vests that meet the National Institute of Justice bullet resistance standards. These vests have been credited with saving over 2,500 lives of law enforcement officers since they came out. Training has been addressed over and over in my career. Early on, the police academy ran for about 8 weeks of basic training. Today, officers receive 16 weeks of training that utilizes the most advanced scenario-based curriculum. Construction of the new Public Safety Academy and the 16-week basic training standard were priority projects of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and with the help of the Oregon legislators, that's now a reality. Communications. Heard a lot about communications. Early in my career, radio communications between officers and dispatch were rudimentary and unreliable. Today, technically sophisticated dispatch centers utilizing the very best technologies provide officers with real-time information that they require. Many departments utilize mobile data systems and allow officers to access critical information in advance of confronting a threat. All those were done without going to arbitration. The future of law enforcement. Managers are demonstrating commitment to safety for the future. Interoperability, another big issue. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association are asking the Legislative Assembly to invest in a statewide system designed to provide police officers and firefighters, along with ambulance personnel, public works, and others with the ability to communicate on shared interoperable emergency channels. All three associations adopted membership-wide resolutions to support the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. Members from each association serve on the State Interoperability Executive Committee, and five sheriffs, five police chiefs, and five fire chiefs committing significant time to serve on a 5x5x5 committee designed to assist in the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network project during the 2007 legislative session. We're looking to the future for our officers' safety. The State Association of Chiefs of Police have commissioned a, quote, safe shield, end quote, task force to ensure that the officer of the future is prepared to confront the challenges and dangers of law enforcement's profession safely. Let me read from the task force description. The Safe Shield Project critically examines the police uniform and looks at technology to improve the uniform as a protective communication information system. The goal is to have a design for the uniform that will incorporate protective systems into the uniform. This is a long-term project which encourages imagination, creative thinking to find ways to the ultimate goal of total police protection. In addition to considering uniform improvements, the Safe Shield Project will review and recommend sound procedural policies and advocate increasing and improved training with the end goal of sending officers home safely every day. Quickly, let me repeat what I said earlier. In my experience, issues of safety have been handled promptly and fairly without the need for labor attorneys or arbitrators. And the reason is simple. Law enforcement executives are deeply concerned about the safety of our officers.
Chief Adams, on the last part, since we do have the written testimony, can you summarize for us, please?
Yes, sir, I will. I guess I want to cut to the point where the impact on local communities needs to be decided by, I think, the local folks. We can only provide the best level of services our funding will allow. And to have these kind of things be decided by arbitrators or to be forced to go to labor arbitration every time, I think will stifle a lot of the communication that goes on with our officers and will, in the end run, be a bad thing and not allow for the safety changes that are happening now because we do these things without having to go to this confrontation. Management's not the evil empire. We work with these guys every day. We know every one of them, and we care about them. I don't think this police system is broken, and I think this bill would be bad for all police officers, and the Chiefs Association opposes it. Thank you.
Thank you. Chief Groves, before you get started, congratulations on your success as becoming the new chief for the Eugene Police Fire Department.
Thank you very much, Chair Prozanski. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Randy Groves. I'm the fire chief for the city of Eugene. I've been with the Eugene Fire Department for almost 27 years, during which time I've worked my way up through the ranks from recruit firefighter to chief of department. During that time, I also spent almost 10 years as a labor leader, as both a board member and finally vice president for IAFF Local 851. I have respect for labor's position, and I don't fault them for attempting to improve their level of influence and leverage on this issue. At the same time, I feel compelled to address what I see as potential impacts in the future on our operation. As fire chief, not only do I have to look out for the safety and welfare of our people, which is very important to me, I have to also look out for the safety and welfare of our community, which we are sworn to serve and protect. Staffing translates into service delivery for our community, and I have concerns about handing the ultimate decision of how we deliver our essential services over to an outside arbitrator. Outside arbitrators most likely have no fire service training or experience and no direct ties to our community. The decision of how we protect our community should remain under local control and rest with the trained and experienced professionals charged with managing the service. In these times of scarce resources and competing interests, our community has managed to keep public safety at the forefront where it belongs. For example, with labor's help, we managed to staff an additional fire suppression company in Eugene last year. At the same time, there remains a delicate balance that needs to be managed by those on the local front. This balance would most certainly be impacted should we lose control over the decision of how to staff our service. For example, should our fire department be directed by an arbitrator to up staffing levels in our fire suppression companies, without any additional funding, we would be forced to close a number of existing companies to achieve such a directive. In my professional opinion, this would not be a worthwhile trade-off for either our public, our organization, or our firefighters. I also want to address Senate Bill 400 in the context of unfunded mandates, which we are having an accumulated effect on our ability to deliver service. Sources for these mandates include state agencies as well as federal government. For example, in the Oregon Health Division has recently upgraded the requirements for EMT intermediate. That requires 44.75 hours of mandatory bridge training. For my agency, this translates into $115,000 unfunded liability for FY08. This is just one of many that are coming down the pike. Mandated increases in staffing would also pose an unfunded liability for my organization. Likewise, our industry standards, as provided for under the National Fire Protection Association, continue to become more stringent and prescriptive. Although these standards are generally good for our communities, our service, and our firefighters, they come at a cost. A further frustration to me is the fact that these mandates and standards are most frequently developed in isolation from one another, and they tend to have a cumulative effect on our ability to function and pose an ever-increasing burden on our limited resources. How do unfunded mandates correlate with Senate Bill 400? Simply, Senate Bill 400 has the potential to become a very large unfunded mandate. In addition to labor's concern for safety, I want to make it clear that we too have a strong concern and commitment for the safety of our people. It is morally and ethically our responsibility to protect the protectors, and I believe we do a very good job of it. To this end, we have a number of joint labor management committees, including our safety committee, which is chaired by a captain in the bargaining unit. We have a joint labor management relations committee that our union, which is here today as well, attend, and we can talk about anything. We have a joint labor management committee that specs our apparatus and our safety equipment. And we take those recommendations and we implement them. In one case, we spent well over $600,000 for all new SCBA based on the specifications developed by our firefighters who went through a series of tests. So we do take this seriously. We are currently participating in the Oregon OSHA Safety and Health Achievement Recognition Program, known as SHARP, which helps us align with the best safety practices in industry. We have attained accredited agency status under CFAI, which is the Center for Fire Service Accreditation International. As a part of this accreditation process, we have undergone rigorous review of our safety standards, processes, and procedures, and then continue to report on them annually back to CFAI. They help us maintain our industry standards. We have a department-sponsored representative who is from the bargaining unit sitting on the Oregon OSHA Firefighter Safety Advisory Committee, which helps OSHA set and maintain safety standards for firefighter safety and health issues. We adhere to the Fed OSHA and OR OSHA two-in, two-out mandated standard, which provides for firefighter safety at emergency scenes. And we already meet or exceed the National Fire Protection Association's NFPA 1710 standard, which is the organization and deployment standard for placing enough firefighters on scene to meet the call. Over the past 5 years, we have greatly improved our fire ground tactics to provide more tools and safer techniques to engage in fire suppression activities. We have adjusted our training program and pumped well over $1 million into our training facility in the name of promoting service effectiveness and firefighter safety. Our local firefighters union has also been very effective in lobbying our local city council and budget committee to further their agenda, which in most often is in alignment with the department's agenda, and I commend them on that. In my community, labor already has multiple avenues for furthering their agendas and achieving their goals. In addition, safety is defined as a mandatory subject of collective bargaining under the PACPA, as you've already heard in previous testimony. It just changes the standard of what is being looked at with Senate Bill 750, and I'm concerned with the ambiguity in potential safety. I mean, our jobs are dangerous. Our training is dangerous. Everything we do has a potential safety impact, and it's something we do our darndest to try and minimize the impact on our people. At the same time, with such ambiguous language, I just don't see where that will stop when we start discussing these issues. And finally, in making your decision, I ask that you consider not only the interests of our public safety workers, but also the public that we are here to serve. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have five people that are left. All of them are in support, and if you want to come up, I'm willing to stay here and listen to the testimony. I'm not going to require the rest of my committee to stay because we are after the hour that our committee was closed down. But I will take testimony from the following five: Roy Carter, L. Ray Sampson, and Dan, I guess it's Weck. Okay. Why don't we go with those three? And then the other two I have is, I believe it's Robert King or Kern. I can't tell the last name.
Mm-hmm.
King. And then Daryl, looks like Garrison.
Garrison.
Yeah, and then the other question I have is for those that are in the audience that are not up here testifying or have not testified, was there anyone else that did not get signed up that did want to testify on Senate Bill 400? If not, then we'll go ahead and go with these five that I've called out, this first panel. And whoever wants to start, if you'll give us your name and your testimony, I'd appreciate it.
I'm going to go ahead and start.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Dan White. I'm a correctional officer at the Oregon State Correctional Institution here in Salem, Oregon. 16-year veteran. I'm also representing the Association of Correctional Employees. We pretty much are represented by all the institutions on the west side of the mountains. Please forgive me because I'm still fighting a cold. Before you handed out some packets of some basic selected measures that we're talking about here, we keep seeing the hashing over the issues of staffing issues for state government. It's wonderful that all the counties have such good relations between their management and their employees. Unfortunately, at the state level, we have a little difficulty with that. The first graph that I give you is the selective measures from January 2004 through October 2006. I broke it down into categories: assaults on inmates, assaults on staff requiring medical attention, assaults with weapons, class 1 physical assaults on staff, class 2 substance assaults on staff, class 1 substance assaults on staff, and class 2 assaults on staff. As you can see, at our 6 major institutions, which, forgive me, I didn't have time to do all the research before this committee, but at our 6 major institutions, in the last 2 years, we've had a total of 1,485 assaults. Now, I know that police officers, I bet that you could take every county in the state of Oregon and you wouldn't have that many police officer assaults ever. And this is in a 2-year time frame. And gentlemen,
and I just want to just set the record straight. I understand that, but it is somewhat apples and oranges because the top main number is 971 is on inmates, so it's not on officers. So let's just make sure we are talking the same thing.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. My point is the issue of Senate Bill 400 is on safety, and I am required by law to protect those inmates. So if they're being assaulted, I have to intervene.
I understand.
Okay. Yes, some of these numbers can be intermixed. Obviously, if I'm breaking up a fight and I get assaulted by medical, I'm going to be in that category, et cetera. However, keeping in mind, that's only through October 2006. Since then, we've had several major incidences at our institutions, so these numbers are considerably higher at this time. This information also comes from our Corrections Management Information System, which is available to everybody on our DOC computer website. We've heard testimony today about how wonderful labor and management communicate in some organizations. Unfortunately, we don't see that. I sit on a ad hoc committee, which is with the Prison Population Management Section. And I would like to point out to you on page 1 of that, they sent out a superintendent survey. And these are answers from our superintendents or their designees of our institutions that we work at. On the second page, the question was asked, are there any obstacles created by your mission today? Excuse me, if I could back up, please. The first page is, what is your mission of your institution? And I'll be brief in the interest of time.
I'm going to ask you, give you 2 more minutes to complete whatever testimony you want to give us, because we have 4 other people
who
are on borrowed time with my committee. I'm going to have to be paying back debts to society for my members.
Okay, 2 minutes. Basically, then you get the gist as a brief summary. Most of our superintendent's mission is basically to provide public safety and provide a safe working environment. These are their words or their designees' words. But yet on the second thing, the next question that was asked is, are there any obstacles created by your mission today? And Coffee Creek's response was, funding, budgeting, and staffing is an issue. At Mill Creek, it was the same thing. Initial contact and staffing is an issue. Funding limits for staff. At OSCI, where I work, it's an issue. And you know, if I may quote, therefore, in certain areas of the facilities, the inmate-to-staff ratio creates an unsafe environment. The example of recent investigations would support that there's not enough supervision to control the inappropriate behavior. Another example is a fight occurring where non-security staff controlling the circumstances due to the lack of security. We have a real problem with this. When we go to our managers and we ask them to discuss these things, I'm on the negotiations committee. If we bring this up in negotiations, they say, permissive, we don't want to talk about it. Somebody needs to talk about it. In closing, to keep it short, I'd just like to say I support Senate Bill 400. All the members that I work with support Senate Bill 400, and this is why. We need an avenue to be able to discuss these issues. They need to come forth. And I'd like to thank you.
Thank you for your time and your testimony. And thank you for your consideration on limiting it to what you did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, who's next?
I guess I'll take the next try. I'm Roy Carter. I work for OYA and McLaren Youth Corrections Facility. I want to thank all the members and the chair for taking the time to hear me. I'm going to try to dazzle you with some of the jobs I performed in OYA, other than my job as a GLC 2 guard.
Okay.
I served on, I'm not currently on our statewide safety committee. I've served on statewide labor management. I serve at the facilities labor management. And for the last 8 years, I've been sitting at the bargaining table. And it's certainly nice to hear supervisors come up here and say how well they communicate with their other people and get things done. Unfortunately, not everybody works that way. It's nice that we sit down and talk about things, but it's not so nice that we don't get action. The only way we get action is if we bring it to the bargaining table, and management needs to sit down and listen to us, and they will talk to us for 3 or 4 months until it gets toward the end of bargaining, and then they will come out and say, oh, I'm sorry, that's permissive. We don't want to talk about it any longer. In summary, not everybody is blessed with the capability to talk and get things accomplished. Some anecdotal information. We had a problem with what we call spit barriers in OYA. They gave us inadequate spit barriers, talked about them being safety issues. We got nothing done until we had a staff who had to take one of our clients down. The client got a bloody nose. They bit through the spit sock that we were provided, spit into the mouth of the guard or the GLC2 who was escorting them. After that happened, then they decided we were going to get adequate spit protection. And I can sit here and give you anecdotal information like that for 15 minutes or longer. They will not talk to us until something serious happens and maybe have a staff get infected with AIDS, HIV, hepatitis C. In summary, the non-strikeable folks that work need a way of discussing this and having management take it seriously. And the only way that we can see this happening is by getting mandated subjects of bargaining and getting arbitration on them. I thank you for your time, and I support Senate Bill 400, sir.
Thank you.
Are there any questions I could answer for anybody?
Not at this time.
Thank you very much.
For your time. Mr. Sampson?
Yes, sir. Chairman, Senators, my name is Elroy Sampson. I work with Roy at OYA at McLaren. I've been there since 87. I've been involved with labor and management since the second week I got off probation, which was in 87. I'll make it real quick. Dealing with security and safety issues, staffing is that we've had several staff in the past 2 years assault by youth, and the problem we had is that the staffing pattern is not adequate for the number of youth. And we have a unit we'll run with 16 youth in it and 2 staff. It's inadequate. Then we'll go to another unit and it has 19 youth in it right now and 3 staff. There's been 3 assaults in that unit. There's been several units like that. As this happens, as some people said, let's take it to the safety committee. I was one of the people who helped organize and got the safety committee up and running. I know how the safety committee works. We go in, we talk about issues, but as they say, these are issues that we can't talk about. The word I get is it's in the legislature. It's the legislature's got our hands tied. We can't deal with staffing when we have to talk about increasing staffing for work units. What people are not paying attention to is that the assaults of the ones that I can tell you about, the people who are not working for OY anymore, one of them, he lost short-term memory. The other lady that was hit in the head from behind, her doctor and the safe doctor told her, if you get a thump on that spot, you're just going to die because the injury she sustained. And we had one guy last week was assaulted by the same youth 3 times. They're running a unit, which is that intense unit. They run that unit. It should be 4 to 5 staff. They're running on 3. Those things come to your safety committee. We talk about them, or they talk about them, and it says, okay, we can't take this because it's in the legislature. We will consider that. So this is where we are at, dealing with that. And one of the things that sometime I get movement on is that I let management know is that we see a safety problem. You see the safety problem. If staff or client is injured, personally, we will be looking to get some kind of a labor attorney to sue you because we brought these issues to you and you put them on the back burner. We get this quite a bit. Dealing with the issues at OYA and certain units is that the staffing pattern is it's not adequate to where we should have it with the client that we got clientele and with the increase of clientele to the work unit and with the programs that you, the legislature, says, you will implement, such as performance-based standards or the other programs that we do. You need the staffing in order to accomplish this. And if you cut your staffing or don't increase your staffing, you don't have the program. If you don't have the program, we'll go back to housing. We go back to housing, no treatment, to go back out on the street and to come back and they visit him. And you still pay. No, take that back. I pay. And the rest of us pay. And you too. And that's the vicious circle we're in. So we need to try to break that. This bill might help alleviate some of those problems and break that by ensuring that we can work with the youth properly before they get to him. And that's the cost I see. When people are talking about costs sitting up here, I see the cost that we're going to pay by not doing some of the things at the beginning that we need to do in order to prevent at the end. That's where I see some of the costs coming up.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sampson, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The last two speakers or people we have is Robert King and Daryl Garnetson, I guess.
Garrettson.
Garrettson? Okay, I apologize.
That's right, Brian wrote my name.
Yeah, Brian does those things to me all the time.
Hi, I'm Robert King, Mr. King. The Portland Police Association Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing our testimony. Thank you for staying late. This is obviously a matter of great concern to us. As I've listened to the opponent speak about this today, what I've gleaned is a sort of catastrophic and fearful thinking. It's synonymous, I think, to the sky is falling. They say that there'll be this great cost and this great expense, when I don't really think that that fundamentally is the issue for us at all, both as public safety officers and us in the state of Oregon. You know, we as police officers and firefighters and corrections officers provide this vital service out there. In Portland, we make contact with our community about 430,000 times a year. We do it day and night. We do it at great risk to ourselves. And today, we have absolutely no mechanism by which to talk to our employer about the issues that are critical to our safety. We can't talk about cars. We can't talk about pistols or vests. We can't talk about staffing. We can talk about wages and health insurance benefits, but, you know, I represent officers, sergeants, detectives, and criminalists who range in their age and experience, and yet they all are out there taking on what I see as this great and real risk. They are injured doing the work. You've heard some stories here today. They are, in fact, killed doing this job, protecting our community. Now, we are often viewed in policing controversially. But the reality is that in the overwhelming majority of the cases, we're doing things that help people and that protect people. And we're coming to you, the legislature, and we're asking you to level the playing field for us. Give us the opportunity to talk with our employers about the issues that are really critical to us and to our families. The city of Portland, unfortunately, can afford to spend millions of dollars on the single most expensive park and ride in history. You maybe have seen that the tram rides are on sale now for $4. By spending that money, they have avoided hiring more police officers. We have the same number of officers in the Bureau today that we did 6 or 8 years ago. We've added no one. It has not been a priority. We would love to have had the opportunity to talk about it. Now, I've taken cases to arbitration, and we would take this matter, safety broadly, judiciously to arbitration. And with every arbitration, you know there's great risk. It is no guarantee. It is just simply a chance. It is a chance to discuss an issue that's critically important to us, not just because it affects us, but because it affects the safety of our whole community. And we ask you to support Senate Bill 400 because it matters. It matters to the safety of our officers and to the safety of our community. And that the negative, catastrophic, fearful things that you've heard here today aren't borne out by anyone's experience.
Thank you.
Chair, Senator Gordley, my name is Daryl Garrettson. I'm one of those infamous labor attorneys that you heard referred to in previous testimony. Our firm represents approximately 120 labor organizations in the states of Oregon and Washington. Over 90% of them are public safety labor organizations. They include such things as the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Gratian Police Officers Association, the Tigard Police Officers Association, several of the associations that are here today. Talking fast, I'm going to try and keep it short and sweet. One of the concerns I had is you heard a bunch of discussion about balance, the balance between resources and safety. The problem we have is the people who are balancing it are the people that manage the resources. The people who go out and do the job, that get shot at, that get assaulted, that get beat up, etc., they don't get to say where the fulcrum is on that balance. They don't get to raise it. Same thing I want to point out about the horror stories about how we're going to bankrupt the state of Oregon. Washington has binding interest arbitration for uniformed personnel. They've had it for the police officers and deputy sheriffs for approximately 17 or 19 years. They've had it on the correction side for approximately 10 years. Their arbitration is what we used to have before Senate Bill 750. So it's not even last best offer. It's open-ended. Each side can bring their issues in.
And the arbitrator can choose between?
The arbitrator can choose from, you select from a list. The selection is very similar. Safety is a mandatory subject. Bargaining in the state of Washington, I think if you contact the PERC, the Public Employment Relations Commission up there, collect their arbitrations, you will not find a single horror story borne out where safety somehow bankrupted some jurisdiction. I would suggest to you the primary reason that arbitrations, or that the primary expense that comes to a jurisdiction out of arbitrations is wages and insurance. If they truly want to save money, take away our right to bargain wages and insurance. That's where the cost of personnel comes from. Want to just mention the fact that we won more in the last 3 years must indicate that we're better at addressing to a neutral the statutory criteria than they are. To a certain extent, so much sour grapes. Because the arbitrators don't work if they get a reputation of favoring one side or the other. Simple as that. They get struck. Now, I wanted to give you some very... I want to tell you why OROSHA doesn't work very quickly. First reason is that the investigators for OROSHA have no expertise in public safety. Second, if they choose not to cite a jurisdiction, there's no appeal by the employee. So if you call OROSHA in, they inspect it, they decide there's not a safety violation, there's no way you can challenge that inspector's determination. The employer can appeal it if they're cited. Third is that a citation just takes more money out of the public resources. In fact, you get them cited. Primary example is that OROSHA did cite the city of Portland on communications. They cited state police on communications, both in 1993. And I would suggest that if you monitor our current communication system, it sucks just as bad now as it did then, and we have a lot more people in the state. Communications are so bad, and we can't even bargain over it. State police troopers, in order to have backup, have two radios in their cars. One's on the state frequency, one's on the county frequency. We just had a pursuit in Washington County where the trooper not only is driving on snowy, icy roads attempting to pursue a stolen truck with identity theft, etc., that tried to run him over later, but he's trying to manage two microphones. We don't even have earpieces for state police. A fitted earpiece allows you to here and not the other side here. I could give you an example of a trooper that got shot in the head because his pack set didn't work. He had to have his, it happened in Gilchrist, so he had to have it on the loudspeaker. The suspect heard there was a warrant. Suspect comes up with gun, shoots trooper. But as opposed to the individual stories, I'm going to give you a real short example of what we mean by ability to bargain, and it involves tasers and the city of Beaverton. The city of, I'm not even going to mention the fact, state police, we haven't been able to bargain tasers. They still don't have them. But the city of Beaverton decided to equip their officers with tasers. Made us all very happy. But the chief decided the only way you could carry a taser is you had to take a ride. You had to get tased yourself. So as an association, we said, well, you know, the infliction of pain is a mandatory subject of bargaining. So we want you to bargain over the infliction of pain. The city's response was, fine, we'll make it voluntary. Now you have no right to bargain. So the only way you can carry a taser in Beaverton is you have to agree to take a 5-second ride. The chief's particular theory is, I want you to know what it feels like. And of course, our response is, well, you allow us to carry a gun, but you don't allow it, require us to get shot. I mean, we can all visualize what 50,000 volts do. We ended up with one officer who wanted to carry a taser, whose doctor advised him not to because of a bad back, took the ride, ended up missing a week and a half work because he re-aggravated a back injury he had suffered on the job. The city of Salem used to require, in order to carry a taser, that you take a ride. The deputy chief ended up suffering a concussion when he fell to the ground, lost his sense of taste, and they no longer require it. The other example I want to give you, you heard in corrections about the infamous cocktail of feces and urine that all officers get thrown on. What we have tried to bargain with the Department of Corrections is the number of cells equipped with plastic screens. What the Department of Corrections does is they move the inmate. They say there's no longer an immediate impact on safety, therefore we don't have to bargain. And that result is when the next inmate comes in that wants to dump a cocktail on you, you get to shower. And if, unless there are any questions, that concludes my quick summary.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, for this witness, but I would like to address Mr. King. How are you?
Very fine, Senator.
And I just have to say for the record, there's absolutely no way that I was going to leave a hearing with Robert King, head of our police union, in the room.
Thank you, Senator.
Just want to say that. I have a request, please. We have a letter submitted for the record from Chief Sizer, and I don't know if you've seen the record.
I have, unfortunate, and I think inaccurate. Yes.
Okay. And I want to ask if you would be willing to put together a response based on the examples that she provides in her letter. She makes a case for why Senate Bill 400 would delay or prevent our police supervisors, I'm reading directly from her letter, from responding directly to community concerns or unforeseen events on a very short notice. If you could give us something in response that reflects your perspective, it would help me flesh out a better understanding of the pros and cons of this public policy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, if I could just throw in for something for you to think about in regard to her letter, and that is overtime, either voluntary or mandatory, is already a mandatory subject of bargaining. If, in fact, the Portland Police Association was going to respond in the manner in which the chief alleges they might, they could have, because that was all overtime assignments, and they didn't. And I think that speaks volumes for what kind of stories the other side is presenting to you.
Mr. King, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, thank you. We'd be happy to provide a response to the chief's letter. And I thought perhaps it might also interest you to know that the City Council of the City of Portland, the four of the city commissioners are sponsoring a bill which will be heard and voted on next Wednesday that indicates the City of Portland's position with respect to this particular bill is that they will be neutral. They will be neutral to the bill. It's only Mayor Potter that has abstained from that vote. And so, despite the chief's letter, that will be the position of the City Council for the City of Portland.
Okay. The other thing I would like to say, again on the record, having observed your work, worked with you over many years, I commend you for your courageousness. You're always one who speaks the truth as you see it from your perspective. That takes a lot of courage in the times that we live in. I just want to acknowledge that and honor that, and we'll see what happens with this particular piece, but thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 400. I want to thank everyone that was here, very patient and willing to listen to everyone. Have a nice evening.